proposed, the road would drive right through the Eisenbeck Isthmus, which lies between some of the largest eelgrass beds in the world.
Congress takes up the Eisenbeck Road debate from the Alaska Public Radio Network. This is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 11th of March. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, mushers talk about their standout dogs on the trail, including a mini Brett Favre.
You know, it's just a dog that a lot of people write off, you know, because she's 8.5 years old and she's had a really good career, but she's not done yet, you know?
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a high-risk chronic medical condition or other uninsurable reasons, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. ACHIA was created by the state legislature to meet the needs of Alaskans, and several plans are available. Talk to an independent insurance broker. Information also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the ACHIA.
An autopsy has concluded that a rural teacher was killed by animals. And the head of the Alaska State Troopers says wolves are the likely suspects. However, Colonel Audie Holloway says the autopsy could not say for sure what animals are to blame. Holloway says DNA tests might determine whether wolves are responsible for the death of 32-year-old Candace Berner. Berner's body was found Monday night about a mile outside of Chignik Lake, a community on the Alaska Peninsula about 474 miles southwest of Anchorage. The body had been dragged off the road to the village's lagoon and was surrounded by wolf tracks. Holloway says the autopsy ruled out other causes of death. Berner has been teaching in Alaska only since August and was originally from Pennsylvania. According to an Anchorage Daily News report, there is only one other documented fatal wolf attack in North America. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is looking at the environmental impacts of a proposed land swap and road project in the Alaska Peninsula's Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge. Congress passed legislation signed into law last year calling for the land exchange and allowing for a road to connect two communities, but environmentalists are still fighting the plan. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
The controversial Eisenbeck land swap and road were okayed by Congress and the president, but they're not a done deal. First, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service will prepare an environmental impact statement and determine if the swap and the road are in the public's best interest. The road upsets environmentalists. It would connect the communities of King Cove and Cold Bay. Cold Bay has a World War II-era runway that makes it the fifth biggest air hub in the state. King Cove is just 20 miles away and wants the road to reach the airport and the medical care of the outside world. Stanley Mack is mayor of the Aleutians East Borough and has lived in King Cove his whole life. He says federal decision makers may not see many projects with such strong local backing.
I bet most do not have nearly as much grassroots support as this land exchange. I wonder how many other hearings in Washington, D.C. have been the results of a community request for a single lane gravel road less than 20 miles long.
Mack traveled to Washington this week to speak at a public scoping meeting hosted by the Fish and Wildlife Service. They were in Anchorage a week ago and will hold meetings in late April in five Aleutians Eastboro communities. At Thursday's hearing, 9 people testified against the swap and 5 testified for it. One of the supporters was Republican Congressman Don Young.
We're talking about American lives. We just had a terrible tragedy in Haiti, and everybody rose to help those people. We responded, and now I believe through this study, you will respond to the people of King Cove. When you have a pregnant mother that has the possibility of a miscarriage, and they can't get to Cold Bay because we didn't build the road.
But it's not like the residents of King Cove have no way of getting to the big airport. They have a hovercraft, one bought with taxpayer dollars as a solution to their isolation. Retired Fish and Wildlife employee Lenny Corin remembers when this issue first came up about 15 years ago and all the effort behind the decision to go with the hovercraft rather than a road. He says since the hovercraft went fully operational 3 years ago, it's worked. Corin thinks the road is unnecessary and feels so strongly about it that he traveled to D.C. from his home in Washington State. He says the problem with the hovercraft is the cost, but that can be fixed.
The apparent issue today is not health and safety, but the financial viability of the hovercraft link that was paid for with U.S. taxpayer dollars. And now instead of addressing that need, we're embarking upon a $1.5 to $2 million evaluation process and then potentially a $20 to $25 million construction project when a less damaging and more cost-effective solution would be to establish a fund to subsidize the operation of the hovercraft.
Besides, Corin believes the hovercraft is more reliable than a 30-mile road that will need to be plowed and maintained during harsh weather conditions. Environmentalists like Lauren Hurl with the Alaska Wilderness League want to protect the lands and waters used by birds, bears, and sea lions.
As proposed, the road would drive right through the Eisenbeck Isthmus, which lies between some of the largest eelgrass beds in the world. They provide food vital to the survival of more than 250,000 migratory birds.
Hurl says conservationists fear this could set a precedent for wilderness areas across the country.
The proposed road would be the first ever to bisect a congressionally designated wilderness, despite the fact that by definition, wilderness is meant to be a place where humans leave no mark. If this road were built, it would open the door to similar destructive projects in other wilderness areas.
But Borough Mayor Stanley Mack says his people want the eelgrass, the birds, the bear, and caribou healthy because they're part of their subsistence lifestyle and culture.
I expect the mitigation measures will protect the resources that are so valuable to the King Cove and Cold Bay residents. Nobody knows better than the people living in the Aleutians East Borough what a jewel the Eisenbeck Refuge is and how important protection for the future generations of the Aleuts is.
Right now, Fish and Wildlife is taking comments from anyone about what should be covered in the environmental impact statement. This scoping process will go on until May 1st, and then a draft EIS will come out next spring. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
The House today passed its version of the operating budget that will go into effect July 1st, but it did so leaving questions unanswered about the future of a gas line from the North Slope. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
The result of the vote on the budget was never in doubt by members of either majority or minority caucuses. However, members did not solve the only serious concern by Democrats and the Parnell administration. At issue was a last-minute budget cut and contingency language put into the bill by the Finance Committee. It took away 70% of the money the administration wanted for work associated with the development of the Aegea gas line. The language also held much of what was left of the money until there were precedent agreements, firm commitments from companies wanting to ship on the line. Opponents of the move see it as a way of destroying the project coming from TransCanada and Exxon, simply by pulling money away from it. Anchorage Democrat Harry Crawford wanted that money restored and the language to be less binding. He said delaying the work the money would pay for would put the state a year behind in getting it done and would jeopardize the entire project.
This is not much money, but what we're talking about here is not just billions, but tens of billions, maybe hundreds of billions over the life of this project. We need to do everything in our power to ensure Alaska's future. Now is not the time to back off. Now is not the time to slow down in our effort to get a gas pipeline.
Finance co-chair Mike Hawker said the committee's action was not as serious as Crawford and other opponents made it sound. He said there's money for the administration to monitor the pipeline's progress, and the committee's language introduced an element of caution into the development.
We are asking in the passage of this budget the administration to continue its efforts at monitoring the development of this project, but really be ready as we assemble here next year, as we always do with every budget cycle, be back here with the knowledge of whether there has been a successful open season or not a successful. If it's been successful, all the money they want is flowing. If it's not successful, then I think we all need to sit down, regroup, talk with the administration amongst ourselves on what is the best strategy forward.
Crawford's amendment failed with only 13 votes in favor of it. On final passage, the budget got praise from Democrats, and only 6 of them voted against it. Anchorage Democrat Les Guerra, a member of the Finance Committee, praised Hawker's work in putting the plan together. He said the budget's not perfect, but he added, that's likely the thought of all the committee members.
I think if all 11 of us on the Finance Committee wrote it ourselves, we would come up with 11 different budgets, and I bet you they'd total pretty close to the same amount of money. We would have 11 different sets of priorities. And that's the hard thing about writing a budget that gets 21 or 40 votes. I think the chair of the operating budget portion of the Finance Committee and the other members of the Finance Committee, I think, did a very good job in trying to figure out how to write a budget that doesn't satisfy just their priorities but meets everybody's.
The budget next goes to the Senate, where the Finance Committee there is prepared for it, already having finished its review at the subcommittee level. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Senate Minority Leader Con Bundy will not seek re-election. The Anchorage Republican made the announcement today. Bundy, a retired commercial pilot, has served in the Alaska legislature since 1993. He spent nearly a decade in the House before winning election to the Senate. Bundy currently leads a 4-member minority in the Senate, which has a bipartisan majority. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Petersburg considers a sweeping ban on smoking.
That irritates me to no end when people start mandating things to me and say, you have no option. This is not your choice.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
The Iditarod leaders are camped out at the remote Cripple checkpoint at this hour. Dallas CV still tops the standings ahead of John Baker and Martin Boozer, but all three have to wait until early morning to leave the checkpoint after they've completed their 24-hour layovers. In the meantime, Jeff King is likely to take back the lead, with Hugh Neff, Mitch CV, and Lance Mackey close behind. Every musher will tell you the real athletes on the trail are the dogs, and on every team there are always a few standouts. As the mushers and their animals basked in the cold sunshine of the Takotna checkpoint yesterday, APRN's Annie Feit got the story on a few of this year's stars.
Ali Zirkel's top leader is a golden brown dog with piercing eyes named Cha-Cha, but the spunky 8.5-year-old has a new nickname on the trail this year, Brett Favre.
She is just a fantastic leader, like fantastic leader, knowledgeable, you know, pretty fast, usually makes the right moves, and it means that this is her chance. This might be her last chance, might not be her last chance, but we think this is her chance, and I don't know, I feel like she's close to going to the Super Bowl, so I just, you know, it's just a dog that a lot of people write off, you know, because she's 8.5 years old, and she's had a really good career, but she's not done yet, you know?
After a morning nap in the sun, it's time for a snack of watered-down dog chow with whitefish.
Oh my goodness, that looks good. Hey, there's fish in there. It's your favorite.
It looks like a lot of food for a small animal, but Zirkel says it's a light meal for these dogs, packed with plenty of nutrients.
So we try not to do the Arkansas You Can Eat Buffet. We try to do the Vermont cheddar cheese and bagel with spinach and some healthy harvest chips on the side.
Harvest chips?
No fried chicken.
Inside the busy Takotna checkpoint, Fairbanks musher Sven Holtman is sitting down to a meal himself. He makes a hearty cheeseburger with lettuce and tomato disappear in a few hungry bites. It doesn't take much to get him talking about his favorite subject, his team. He's especially smitten with a 3.5-year-old leader named Dolmar.
I mean, it's just crazy. He does everything perfect. He charges down the trail. He eats. He laughs at me. He looks at me like, hey, I have it under control. Don't worry about it. I'm in lead. I mean, it's just one of those dogs who just does everything for you. in a fashion that's just absolutely breathtaking and actually it's emotional.
When Holtman talks about his dogs, he sounds like a proud father. He says they're the best in his eyes no matter how they finish. Back outside the checkpoint, Denali musher Jeff King is sure his team of dogs is the best he's had in 2 decades of mushing the Iditarod. He says one standout surprise for him is a 3-year-old named Cadet who only made the cut at the very last minute.
Number 17 each year, more times than not, turns out to be a little superstar. And I'm always glad that I did, even though so much emotion and panic or caution goes into picking that dog and having some doubts that made me doubt she was the right one. And then she's just having a blast and she's awesome.
Nearby, Dee Dee Jonro is on her knees in the straw, massaging a runny ointment into the sore spots on each of her dogs.
I know, Sparky Larky. I know. Come here, honey. We gotta check yous, make sure yous have no rubs or sores. Oh, yes.
Jonro says this is her favorite part of long-distance racing.
I just love fussing over them. It's just so much fun just to massage them, and then they like it, and then, you know, you get to play and futz, and I mean, that's really my attraction to racing. I love it.
As her dogs soak up the extra attention, Jonro acknowledges she wouldn't mind a massage herself right now, but she also doesn't mind waiting several hundred miles for it. In Takatna, I'm Annie Feit.
The wood sled has all but disappeared from the Iditarod Trail. Mushers now prefer to use sleds made from aluminum or composite materials, which are lighter and more flexible. But in the villages, locally made wood sleds are still common, and a few dedicated craftsmen still make them in the traditional style. Billy McCarty is one such craftsman. APRN Iditarod Trail reporter Tim Bodoni visited McCarty in his shop overlooking the Yukon River in Ruby.
Traditional sled building begins in the forest with the selection of the right tree. Billy McCarty has developed a keen eye for birch, the sled builder's wood of choice in the interior. It's a skill he learned from his father.
He would tell me what type of birch to pick, and in the flat areas out in the flat countries where there's it's swampy, a lot of sap to the birch and more flexibility. You know, he'd always tell me that the hillside birch, he never used that. It's brittle. It dries. You never know when it's going to break, and it'll break like a frozen candy bar. And I learned that the hard way by trying it.
McCarty made his first sled in 1959. Since then, he estimates he's made about 100, including freight sleds, racing sleds, and children's sleds, two of which rest on workbenches in his small and tidy shop. The slats of clear-grained, yellowish-white birch that make up the sled are about half an inch thick, yet remarkably strong for their weight and size.
I could take a piece of that's dried like this, this piece here, and I couldn't break it over my knee. It's so strong after it's dry.
After it's cut and planed, the wood only needs 3 or 4 days to be dry and ready. The pieces that will become the handlebar, the runners, and the U-shaped front of the sled, referred to as the brush bow, all need to be bent. And that's done with steam, often turning McCarty's little log-sided shop into a riverfront sauna.
It gets hot and sweaty, and I gotta open the door, and then I get chilled, and especially in the wintertime. I'd rather bend all these in the spring when it's warm out, then I can just do it outdoors.
The steam softens the wood, and then it's clamped into forms to set it into the necessary shapes. When it comes time for assembly, McCarty sweats the details, insisting on mortise and tenon joints instead of just slapping the pieces on top of each other and screwing them together. The finished product is designed to be sturdy in some areas and ready to twist in others, so that the driver can easily steer the sled. McCarty also gives the sled driver more control by making his sled slightly narrower in the front than the back. It's so subtle that it almost escapes notice, but McCarty insists that it makes a big difference in how the sled performs.
It'll stay right on the trail. You can sit in it, and then it'll just steer by itself. I've seen sleds that they didn't do that, the old-timers. Some of them didn't learn to do that. It was kind of out, you know. They just built it straight. They didn't draw this runner in. And I can see those sleds just, you know, falling off the trail. And I learned that by watching that.
Metal sleds might be lighter and more flexible, but they're not as easy to repair as wood sleds. If a piece happens to break, a new piece can be bolted on with common tools, even out on the trail. McCarty thinks of sled building as a hobby, even though he's sold dozens of sleds to mushers and visitors from the lower 48 over the years. He's also driven his own sleds to several victories in village dog races along the Keokuk and Yukon rivers. As for the future of sled building in the McCarty family, Billy has passed down the lessons that he learned from his own father about choosing the right wood. That's only the first step in continuing this tradition.
My grandkids and my sons help me. They go out and they can find the birch for me. They know what to look for, but they don't try building it yet. That's the part I'd like to see them do, you know, actually build them.
In Ruby, this is Tim Bodoni.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by AT&T, your world delivered. Details at www.att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266. Every day, people all over Alaska are discovering how public transportation benefits them, their businesses, and their communities. Public transportation in Alaska provides 7 million rides a year to work, medical appointments, shopping, school, social opportunities, wherever people need to go. With public transportation available, the going is good. Find out more at goodgoingalaska.com. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Mobility Coalition, a nonprofit organization.
A proposed smoking ban ordinance has passed a first reading with Petersburg City Council approval, and the ban could go before voters this fall. The sweeping non-smoking ordinance is thought to be too restrictive by some, and the measure could see some changes before the public gets to decide on it. From member station KFSK in Petersburg, Matt Lichtenstein reports.
Juneau's done it, Sitka has too, while voters in Wrangell opposed it. Now Petersburg's considering it, a broad ban on smoking. Entitled the Smoke-Free Air Act of 2010, the ordinance would generally prohibit smoking in all public buildings and businesses and places of work. None of Petersburg's city councilors smoke, but they had a mix of opinions on the measure. Mark Jensen thought it went too far. For instance, Jensen pointed out that unlike Juneau's ordinance, Petersburg's proposed measure provided no exceptions to the ban on workplace smoking.
The way I read it, a person that has a small business, and if one of his employees smokes or if he wants to smoke in his business, he won't even be allowed to.
Jensen said he didn't like the proposal, but he said he was glad it was going to a vote of the people. Also, Mayor Al Dwyer expected the measure would see a number of changes before it gets that far.
I think it would be unfair for seven non-smokers to vote on a smoking issue, so the only place to do this is in a ballot.
The second reading is formally considered the time for public testimony, though in Petersburg the council typically allows public comment at any point in the process. Still, no one from the public turned out to talk about the ordinance Monday, and no one proposed any changes. Under the current language, the ban would include all government-owned facilities as well as private buildings. There would be no smoking in bars, restaurants, retail stores, and other for-profit or non-profit businesses, organizations, and places of employment. That includes private clubs. Smokers would also see a variety of restrictions outside. For instance, they'd have to stay 10 feet away from building entrances. They would not be allowed to smoke at the ball fields or within 10 feet of playgrounds. In general, the measure would not affect smokers in privately owned homes. There was little debate over the pros and cons of a smoking ban at Monday night's meeting, though Mayor Dwyer expressed support for the idea.
And I'm not against people who are smoking. I just don't want them smoking at me. The ordinance is not about the customer, it's about the employee. Even if that employee smokes, the next employee might not. It's the injury it does, secondhand smoke, you know, to somebody else.
Councillor Dan Hickman spoke against the ban. He said he didn't think the government should impose such a rule on a private business owner.
That irritates me to no end when people start mandating things to me and say, you have no option. This is not your choice.
The language in Petersburg's ordinance comes from a national group called Americans for Non-Smokers' Rights. The organization lobbies for no-smoking legislation at the local, state, and federal levels. The vote was ultimately 4-1. If the council passes the measure twice more, it will go to a vote of the public in the 2010 general election next October. If voters approve, the smoking ban would go into effect the 1st of November. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
The 2010 season for halibut opened on Saturday, and despite a nasty blizzard that kept most boats in port, Homer stayed true to its reputation as halibut capital of the world by taking in the first large load of the year. A whopping 42,500 pounds of flatfish was offloaded in Homer Saturday and was auctioned online this week by Auction Block Seafood. Company owner Kevin Hogan said the prices were way beyond expectations, with the first fresh halibut of the year fetching between $5.95 and $6.25 per pound.
That's the highest I have ever heard of anywhere. I think it was a new record. I think it was the only fish available and the only fish on the horizon. Since then, I think there's been a couple more small deliveries come in, probably to Seward and Kodiak. But with the weather and everything, that's all that's available anywhere. So there hasn't been anything coming in Canada. Southeast has had just paltry deliveries. So supply and demand.
By comparison, last year's starting prices were in the range of $3 to $3.50 per pound. On the Anchorage-based retail website fishx.com Tuesday, some of the fish was selling for $28.98 per pound. Hogan blamed the recent snowstorm across south central Alaska for low initial halibut returns and artificially high prices.
It's slowed things way down. You know, I mean, there's not much fish coming in. If you look at the pending landing site, right now there's 16,000 in south central and 32,000 in southeast, and then that's on top of what's been landed, so not much.
Hogan says he saw many boats leaving the Homer Harbor Wednesday and expects much more halibut to start pouring in by the end of the week. Alaska provides 80% of the halibut caught in the North Pacific, and Homer is the top port for halibut. This year's catch limit is 42.3 million pounds, a drop of more than 3 million pounds from last year. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Tim Bodoni in Galena, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, and Aaron Selbig in Homer. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences. Find qualified Alaskans to fill your company's job vacancies at Alexis, the state of Alaska's virtual career center. Alexis has hundreds of workers for you to browse through, and you can specify details about required levels of experience and other qualifications. Learn more at alexsys.alaska.gov or visit any Alaska job center. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, providing financial tools and resources for purchasing a home or planning for the future. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.